How you doing? How you doing? My name's Bobby Cordo. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the McKean Street Miracle Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at St. Agnes Hospital, Broad McKean Street, South Philadelphia, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. If you're ever in the neighborhood, stop by, and afterwards we'll go out for cheesesteaks. I thank the committee for the privilege of participating in an AA meeting. It's definitely an honor, you know. And chapter 5 of the big book tells me what I'm supposed to do. I will tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But like Charles read it, that was it. You know? I don't know much more. The only thing I can add is that I have a home group. I got a sponsor, and we don't do sobriety dates back home, but I guess in Rome, do as the Romans. My sobriety date is June 2nd of 1988. I grew up in a very blue-collar, ethnic neighborhood in Philadelphia. I got 8 brothers and sisters. You know, my mother was pregnant for 9 years. It's like one of them. They call us Irish twins, you know, 10, 11, 12 months apart. You know. And we had no booze at all in the house. And my father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. My mother suffered from a history of mental illness, abuse, prescription medication, so we had no booze at all in the house. But my grandparents, they lived around the corner from us, and in their basement they had a bar, and that's where all the family functions were held, the christenings, the graduations, and things like that. And that's where I had my very first drink. I was just a kid. I didn't get drunk the first time I drank, but I remember what it was. It was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father. Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And they had this big, the 3 rings in the, you know, the right center school, outfield and scoreboard. And what I remember running around my grandparents' bar that day was I was polishing off the half empties or the half fulls. It all depends on where you look at it. But it was the reaction that I got from my uncles. I never felt a part of, and that's pretty tough to do when you got like, you know, 10 people living in a small 3-bedroom row home. I never felt a part of, and that would be true even to early recovery. You know, I just, something was always missing there. But when I was running around polishing off those beers, my uncles were saying, hey, look at Bobby, look at that. And I craved that attention. I loved that stuff, you know. And my drinking really took off in high school. Most of the kids in the neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school, but my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. And right away, I felt kind of different there because most of the kids who went to this school were from, they were from affluent families from the suburbs, and it was just me and a couple of the dirtballs in the neighborhood who went there. And we used to walk to school, so right away we had a reputation, and it was a really rough part of Philadelphia. And, you know, these guys, they were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, and me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. You know? And we were selling, like, football pools, and if they hit, we never paid off. I mean, we just, that's just the stuff we did, you know, because we had a reputation. And you know, because they were scared of us, because we walked to school. That was the reputation. We walked to school, so we're not. And it was one I capitalized on. And I did things in my gut that I knew was wrong, but I did it anyway because the need to be accepted by you guys or the need to entertain you or whatever the case was, it was important to me, you know? And I had a lot of nicknames, and one of those nicknames was Crazy Coil. And I would do things in my gut that was wrong, that went against the teachings of, you know, my family, my upbringing, but I did it anyway because the need to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. I remember my freshman year at a prep. It's a football season, September, we're there 2 or 3 weeks. There was an away game, we rent a bus, there's drinking, there's fighting, there's police activity, just, all just types of insanity. And I loved it, it was just great. And I remember we had to go see the disciplinarian, like, you know, he came and got us and said, look, I'll see you guys Monday morning. He had about 10 of us lined up outside his office. And they were all upperclassmen, except me and another kid from the neighborhood. We're the only 2 freshmen. And he came right up to us, he said, what's with you guys? You guys here like 2 or 3 weeks and you're in this jackpot already? I just shrugged my shoulders, you know, father, just one of them things. And what it was, it didn't take me long to size up situations. You know, I didn't hang out with the smart kids. I didn't hang out with the athletes. I hung out with the kids who were about drinking and acting up and being nitwit. And I felt comfortable that. my sophomore year at the prep, the school was in the middle of North Philly, 18th Street. And a lot of kids, at the end of the day, they would used to take the trolley car 3 blocks to catch the subway. And the reason they would take the trolley, because it was their first introduction to the inner city, and they were scared to walk those 3 blocks to the subway. So they wait a half hour for the trolley, and we could be back and forth. But 2 blocks away, on the corner of 15th and Gerard, there was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And when I was a sophomore, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple different reasons. They had cold beer, they had dancers, and they had all this other stuff. But a lot of times, most of the reasons I went, again, because it's reputation. Like, I was a legend in my own mind. I thought I would have to show how tough we were. And so I would stroll out Gerard Avenue, I'd sit in the Ebony, and I got my blazer on, and I'm like 16, and I look like I'm 12. And as you can imagine by the name, I wasn't from the neighborhood, but they served me. I can now tell you, though, every time I sat in the Ebony, I was terrified. But again, I couldn't let anybody else know. It was, again, playing the role, you know. And I didn't do Bailey either at the prep, but I didn't distinguish myself either. I gave a bare minimum effort required to get by, just enough to keep the heat off my back, you know. And it was amazing how well I could do that, you know. Just when I knew that I would, like, some attention would come my way, I would straighten out for a bit and coast again. And that would be the story of my life. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education. And it kind of ticked my parents off because they made a lot of sacrifices to send me there. So I knew I couldn't stay home because there'd be hell to catch. And I wasn't getting my own spot. I had no money, had no job, no skills, and my options were really limited. So the only other thing left was the service. And I enlisted in the military. And that really wasn't a bright move because back then, nobody else was going. You know, Vietnam had just ended, and it's in the 70s, and the service wasn't popular, but I enlisted. And I wound up getting sent overseas, and I spent 13 months overseas. And that's where my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances. I knew a lot of guys from the neighborhood who had gone over and got whacked on certain things. I never messed with any of that stuff. But I was definitely drunk at this point. I was there a couple months, and several good friends of mine got killed, and I didn't know how to handle that, you know? Because in my house, in my neighborhood, we didn't talk about nothing. It was all surface stuff. And if you lived in a house and you moved out of the house, whether you went to school, got married, whatever the deal was, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the house. Everything stayed within the walls, and if you lived in the house, everything stayed inside you anyway. So my friends got killed, and I didn't know how to handle that. But drinking numbed the pain, and, you know, that's what I did, you know. And again, in the service, you know, I didn't do really distinguish myself, but I didn't do badly either. Just skating by, I didn't want to draw any attention to myself. I came back home, and my tour was up, and I enrolled in St. Joe's College. And I went there for a bit, and I wound up taking a couple civil service exams for the city. And I'm in school, and again, the same old deal, not doing much, you know, again, barely getting by. And one day, it's the end of the semester, it's May, and one of my friends called me up and said, Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. It's one of those businessman specials, you know, one of those weekday games. You want to go to the game? I said, sure, I'll go to the game. Because they wasn't going to miss me in the classroom, I wasn't participating there. So me and four guys from the neighborhood, we went down to the Phillies, and they had since moved. They're playing at Vet Stadium in South Philly. And it was an unusually hot day in May. It was like the sun's beating down on us. And I'm sitting up in the 700 level, the upper deck, drinking that cheap watered-down beer. And the sun's beating down on me, and I'm getting drunk. And I told the guys I was with, I said, you know what? I said, I'm going to run down in the field and meet one of the players. And they said, that's okay, Bobby. And they kind of shrugged me off because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I was like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I did that. I didn't do nothing. I drank. That's all I did. I drank and I made stuff up. So I worked my way down to the old picnic area, and I had jumped over the fence. I ran out in right field. The San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was playing right field for the Padres. And I ran out, and I met him in right field. I said, hi, Dave, how you doing? I shook his hand. And he looked at me. He said, brother, he said, what are you doing out here? And from behind him, I saw the guards coming. I said, Dave, I got to go now. So I start running towards the infield, and I want to slide into second base. And as I was going towards the infield, there was more guards coming from the third base side. And if I knew if I would slide into the base, I'd get caught. So I turned around, I walked to the first base, and the guards were there. And I guess I'm probably as close as a guard as Charles and I are right now. And I'm walking, like, to give myself up. At the last second, I deked the guy, and I ran out the outfield. Now I'm running around like a lunatic. It seems like 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to 3 or 4. Up on the scoreboard, they put Mr. Excitement. I'm running around. I'm running around, and, you know, I'm out of breath. I'm drunk. I'm about to get sick. I got nowhere to go. Like this, it's like a 12-foot fence. Like, I'm stuck there, right? So I finally stop. I'm just waiting in right field, ready for them to come get me. And the guards came in and got me, and they were taking me off the field up through the bullpen, and I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies. He gave me the thumbs up, said, "Where'd it go?" Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from the guards, but that was okay. These guys could have beat on me all day. I was going to be a legend back in the neighborhood, you know? Because if I went back and told that story, no one would believe me. It would, like, bullshit Bob at its finest. But I had 4 guys in the neighborhood. They were my witnesses. I was good. They'd go back to the neighborhood. I knew I could drink all week on this story. Just then, a Philadelphia police lieutenant came up to me. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Are you drunk? Are you high?" I said, "No, I'm just happy. I'm just happy to be here." So not only did he save me from a beating that I was going to get from making the guards look stupid, but he also saved me from getting arrested. And that was important because them civil service exams I took, like, one of them panned out. A couple months later, I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They was hiring anybody back then. I got hired. There were 8,500 of us, and we had to run to the city. We had a mayor at the time, a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. He was a former cop himself, and we were nuts. I'm not even old enough to drink. The drinking age in Pennsylvania was always 21, but I was at this time, the drinking age in Jersey was 18. Now, where I lived in Philly, I could be in Jersey quicker than other parts of Philadelphia. You know, we'd just go right across the Ben Franklin Bridge and drink in Camden. But once I got on the job, you know, my badge took me anywhere. I can go wherever I wanted, you know. And I saw a lot of things on the job that bothered me, but I couldn't tell my coworkers that because I worked with a bunch of older guys. Most of these guys were Vietnam vets, you know, and I didn't want to tell them the way I really felt because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys to the point where I even engaged in behaviors that I knew was wrong and I felt bad doing, but I did it anyway because, again, the need to be accepted by these guys outweighed anything else, you know. I spent my first 10 years in uniform in North Philadelphia, and I saw the ravages of alcoholism day in, day out. It was bad. And at the end of the tour, I would go to the bar and drink, you know, and swap war stories, you know, and lie and not tell the truth what was going on. And it was nuts. It got nuts for me quickly, and that there's just a lot of insane behaviors associated with it because my judgment's impaired. For a long time, I didn't drink on the job. I was off duty, but after a while, like, things were just getting nuts. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. My very first meeting was 1979. I don't tell people I went out because I really never came in. But I'll tell you what happened. I showed up at work one day, and my coworker was drunk, out of his mind. And the supervisor was there. And our job, we had an EAP. We had a counseling unit. And part of the counseling unit, they also had an AA group there, the 369 group. And the supervisor said, "Bobby, take this guy up to the unit." I said, "Okay." I didn't come down the driveway there, and there's a guy sitting on the porch, and I pulled up in my car, and I got this guy out of my car. I said, "Eddie, I'm dropping this guy off. He's detailed here till 4 o'clock. I'll be back at 4 o'clock at the end of the tour to pick him up." He looked me dead in the eye. He said, "Kid, do you want to come in?" I said, "No, I don't." I was insulted that he even asked me, because I know what AA was. AA was for you older guys, you married guys, you guys with three heads, you know. I mean, I knew what alcoholics were. They was those poor people I was dealing with day in, day out. It wasn't me. You know, I had a job, and I was doing pretty good at it. And besides, I was a beer drinker. And you couldn't be an alcoholic drinking beer. The only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Paddy's Day or New Year's Day or payday. But I was a beer drinker, and it was, you know, no way. When I got sober, Eddie was one of the first guys I saw at one of my first outside meetings, and he just smiled when I came in. He said, "So, kid," finally came around. It was just goes to show you that every drink and everything that went with it was necessary for me to hit my bottom, because everybody told me I had a problem. I was the last guy to figure it out. I had an uncle on the job. He was a boss on the job, and we were at a family function one time, and he pulled me off to the side. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better take it easy. One ear and out the other." I had a supervisor one day pulled me off to the side. He said, you know what, kid? You're smart. You're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up, one ear and out the other. When I later got sober, on two separate occasions, I ran into my uncle and that supervisor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that they were trying to 12-step me, but I just wasn't ready. Because I remember talking to my uncle, said, Jimmy, how come you didn't tell me? He just smiled. He said, I told you. He said, you just weren't ready yet. And it was amazing because I was sober a couple years when I ran into my uncle, and he was sober almost 20 at that point. But no one in the family talked about him. Like, in my family, you get sober, you're the black sheep. You know, it's just... he's that bad one. It's just one with... It was just nuts. I was 24 years old, and I shot and killed a 15-year-old kid in the line of work. And it was just a terrible situation. I couldn't be avoided. And I used it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. And there was a lot of people that offered help to me, and I rejected everybody. I just wallowed in self-pity. And, you know, so I wound up getting promoted and transferred in this unit. And I'm now working, and I'm in bars doing my job. And drinking definitely impairs my judgment, and I'm put in a position where I thought that I needed to do other substances, and I got involved in other substances. My drug history is very short. It only lasted 17 months. But it really drove me to my knees and helped me come into the realms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think due to the fifth tradition, that's all I need to talk about that stuff. You know, drinking took me everywhere, you know. And that was definitely one of my nevers. That story I talk about running on the field, I tell that story for a couple reasons. One, it's true. It's you can call those four guys, you know. And secondly, it's the only funny story I got, you know. I wasn't a funny guy, you know, and not only that, but I was a major blackout drinker, but I wasn't a funny guy, and I wasn't an athlete, and I wasn't a lover, and I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent drunk, and if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused every person I came in contact with, and if you got in my way as I was on my mission, you know, shame on you. I just didn't care, you know, and... But I was a major blackout drinker, and there was a lot of things, and I was a blackout drinker from the very first start, like in high school, you know, drinking, and then, you know, we're drinking wine, and, you know, and I would show up on the corner on the next night, and people would tell me, oh, Bobby, you know, you did this, you did that, and I laughed. I said, oh, yeah, I remember, and I didn't. I didn't remember a lot of things. I was a nasty drunk, you know. There were some good times, but you know what? It got ugly for me quickly. So, I'm now caught up in my other deal, and my life is a shambles. The girl I was living with, she left me. My personal life, it's just nuts. People don't want nothing to do with me, you know? And it even affected me on the job. And at this point, it's the only thing I had. In fact, really, my job was like my sense of identity, you know? And even guys were, like, avoiding me because I was like, on a suicide mission, you know? I was doing some really dangerous behaviors because I didn't care, hoping that someone would take my life. I was just nuts. I was sitting home from work one day, and I was reading the paper, and there was an article. It said, alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, marital problems, thoughts of suicide. I'm looking at it, and I'm 4 out of 5. I'm single, but I'm sure if I was married, I'd have been batting 1,000. And, you know, they talk about the moment of clarity or sanity. As soon as it came, it quickly left. But something made me stick that ad out, and I stuck it in my wallet and continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day of 1988, Memorial Day weekend, and I'm on a tremendous load. And guys on my squad went to the bar drinking, and one of the guys I was with, I think we needed to be at midnight that night, and I was taking the day off, but whatever, he was leaving. He said, I need to go home and get some sleep before I go to work. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a ride home, because I didn't think that I was as drunk as he was. And he thought that was a good idea. Now, I've always been a show-off, too. I was always an arrogant guy. And as I was driving him, I was riding out the street, about a block and a half away, I saw somebody on a bicycle. And I always pride of my, I was just nuts, like city cars, I drive up on sidewalks, like trying to chase people, it's just crazy. So I was gonna show off my driving skills in front of my coworker, and I was gonna play chicken with this kid on the bike. And unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction, I ran this kid over. As he was bleeding, lying on the hood of my car. I got out of my car with my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that. I pulled this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw that off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, I made every mark, I scored 10 points, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep, you know? I was just nasty. So I don't know what to do. So I got a case of beer, a bottle of liquor, and some other substances, and I checked into the hotel with the intentions to consume all this stuff to build up the courage in my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the hotel to kick me out, you know? And I didn't know what to do. Well, everything's gone. And I couldn't shoot myself because at this point I was suspended from my job. I no longer had access to a weapon. So I walked over to the window and I opened up the window. I was going to jump out. And I opened up the window. I was on the fifth floor of the hotel. And I looked out and I remembered I was scared of heights. I couldn't jump. Nuts. So I went in the bathroom and I filled the bathtub up with water and I had a blow dryer. And I was going to pull the blow dryer in the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would pull the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about a foot and a half short on cord. So I got 1 foot in the tub, but I'm leaning trying to plug in. And it's okay. I laugh now, but I never want to forget the pain I was in that day. I was just a mess. So I had nothing left to do. So the only other tool that I had left was my car. So I got in my car, took one last spin through my neighborhood. I started up on the Falls Bridge, and I come down the East River Drive, and it's a winding road along the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia. And it was a Wednesday, and it's like about 10:30 in the morning, and that was significant because if it was any other time, I probably wouldn't be here this evening. And I decide I would end my life in an automobile accident. And as I'm coming down the drive, I'm flying, like the speed limit's 30, I'm probably doing 60, and I'm drunk, and I'm cooped, and I'm crying, and I just have no control what's going on. But something came over me. My intention was to go on the oncoming traffic, but something hit me at that point. I didn't want to go on the oncoming traffic because I didn't want to hurt anybody innocently, you know? At this point, I just got tired of hurting other people. And like I said, if you came in contact with me, I hurt you, you know? Whether I did it willingly or unintentionally, it didn't matter. The result was the same. You were harmed. So I decided I would wrap myself around a tree. And I'm still just flying along, and I just lose it. I just started crying. And I finally pull over. I'm at the end of the East River Drive. It's Boathouse Row along Philadelphia. And I pull over, and I step behind the wheel of my car, and I cried like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached into my wallet, and there was that ad that I had clipped out of Daily News about 6 weeks before. And I called the phone number up. I went over. It's no longer there, but at the end of Boathouse Row, it was one of those old glass and closed phone booths. I went in there. I shut the door because, God forbid, anybody, a passerby, go by and hear what I was saying. I called the phone number up. A woman answered the phone, and I just started. I poured my heart out to her. And I spoke to this woman like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. Like, once I started, I couldn't stop. And I figured, I didn't know her from a can of paint. I could always hang up, but I couldn't. I just start talking, and God bless her, she just listened patiently. And when I got done, she said, listen. She said, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital, and somebody be waiting to talk to you. I said, okay. So I got my car. It's like about a 5-6 minute ride. I went over to the hospital. Someone was waiting for me, and they admitted me to the 10th floor of the psychiatric unit. And I spent about 3 days there. It got me kind of stabilized. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville. And I spent another few weeks on their flight deck. And then they put me to an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and dialed that phone number, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I didn't think that I had a problem with booze. I thought maybe it was my short use of other substances. If I left that stuff alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I get this, you know, mental illness. I inherited this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress stuff they're now talking about. I got this from my experience in the service. I got this from experience with my job. Maybe it's the neighborhood I'm living in. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mummer. You know, there's all this other stuff going on. But it couldn't be that I was an alcoholic because I was a beer drinker. So I got put in the alcohol and drug ward at the VA hospital. I'm there about 20 minutes, and I walk into the day room, and they have the 12 steps, the large window shades, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions up on the wall. And I go up. I zip through the steps. I got half of them done. You know, I saw the amends and said, they're screwed. That don't apply to me, you know. That's just nuts. But what happened later that night, two men came up, and I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee, and they came up and carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't identify with, didn't relate to, or just plain didn't like, I'd immediately tune him out. See, I was too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. Now I'm eyeballing this group, right? And there's guys who's divorced, married two, three, four times. I said, man, that's not me. I've never been divorced. You know? I'd never been married, but I'd never been divorced either. There's these guys that said, I'm getting, you know, locked up and, you know, doing all this other stuff. So, well, I've never been arrested, and Lord knows I should have, and I badged my way out of trouble on several different occasions. And I was looking for the differences and not the similarities. A lot of these guys have serious drug problems, and I really don't have a serious drug problem. I just happened to be hooked on something for 17 months, but that wasn't that bad. I'm sure I could leave that alone. I was a narcotics detective. I'm sure I could leave that alone. It was just nuts, the stuff that was going on. But what bothered me the most was at the end of the meeting, everyone got in a circle and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what your people were about, then I don't want nothing to do with you. Because I hated God. And I know they're strong words, but that was the feeling back then. I hated God. And I now know it was a misdirected resentment, but the reason I had that, I was, my mom, mental illness among many other things, she was a fundamentalist, you know, and involved in the charismatic movement. She thought she could speak in tongues, and we had candles and pictures and radio programs and all this other stuff, and there was many times that she was taken out of the house, you know, strapped to a stretcher by fire rescues, babbling, saying something. And I was 15 years old, and I came home from school. I'm in the house about 10, 15 minutes, and walking around. Then I go upstairs, and I come across my mother, and she had slit her wrist. And I remember she looked up at me and she said, Bobby, help me. And I looked down at her and said, good for you. And I walked out of the house. And I got an older guy to get me a quart of wine from the state store. And I stayed out that night and I came home later that night and my dad had told me what happened. I said, oh yeah, how about that? I acted surprised. So that happened when I was 15. I got sober when I was 27. It's 12 years of hating God. And it would be a couple more years before I would even deal with this. So I broke away from the group. I would not say the Lord's Prayer. I wouldn't hold your hands, you know. And then I'm looking around, right? So this is what your deal is. You guys are Jesus freaks, right? And I see these slogans up on the wall. They live and let live, one day at a time, easy does it. And I knew it, you know? I remember it was very rare where I worked that I gave, you know, traffic stops. I just didn't have time because we were in a high crime area. But occasionally we would do it if I was bored. And I would come up and I would see these bumper stickers on cars, like live and let live and easy does it, and one day at a time. And I would just shake my head and say, I got one of these Jesus freaks. And I'm going to hammer them, you know. And I go up, and I'd be talking to them, and they'd be telling me, like, they're going to some sort of meeting. And I said, yeah, right, and I'm writing them up. Now when I got sober and I seen the slogans, now I wonder why everyone in AA is speeding. But, you know, it's just nuts. There was a nurse who took a liking to me, and she was a great lady. And I don't say this facetiously. I'm not trying to get a laugh. But she had to be a member of Al-Anon. She's just really a wonderful lady. And she saw through all my bluff. That's all it was. I was acting all tough. And I'm not a tough guy. I never was. You know, I hid behind my badge. I hid behind a bottle. Fear consumed me, you know. And she saw right through it. And she came up to me like the day before I was getting out. She said, you know what? You're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really the only way you're going to make it. And I need to tell you that's the best piece of advice I ever got, you know. The VA hospital helped me out with a lot of things I had going on. But I would get my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to meetings every single day. Now, I get there late and I leave early. I don't drink coffee, never did. I don't make it. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I would definitely not empty any ashtrays. I wouldn't talk to you people, wouldn't take your phone numbers because most of you are screwballs anyway. I didn't like it. If I walked into a big book meeting or a step meeting that was strictly by accident, I would leave at the break. I had something more important to do. God forbid a tradition meeting. Rules, you know. In my line of work, we don't like to follow them, but boy, do we like to enforce them. They apply to everyone else but us, you know. I was interested in war stories, and that's why I was. And then the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I didn't like, couldn't relate to, or just didn't identify with, I would immediately tune him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. Then you would get in the group and hold hands and say the prayer, and I just wouldn't do it. You know, and so I broke away from the group. I just stood there. And people said, keep coming back. And I thought they were being facetious. I said, all right, I'll keep coming back. Often. And I was nuts. I was crazy as a bed bug. I was sober 8, 9 months. And I'm sitting in this bar. because they sell real good roast beef, right? I'm sitting there having a roast beef sandwich, and I'm drinking seltzer in a rock glass, you know. And guys, you know, it was in my neighborhood, and guys from my neighborhood, they came in, and they start giving me a hard way to go, breaking my stones, making all types of comments. And because, again, it goes back to my arrogance, you know, like doing, I did very well in my job, and got a lot of, you know, publicity. And obviously, towards the end, I got a lot of negative publicity. So I was now back, and that's why I was there. I could tell you something else. You know, 14 years ago, I would have probably told you another reason why I was there. But the truth was, I was arrogant. I want to let people know I'm back. Things are cool. Don't believe everything you read, you know. And these guys come in, they start giving me a hard way to go. One thing led to another, and I just had enough. And I took that rock glass, and I stood up, and I just punched this guy right in the face. Cut him severely, man. He bled like a pig. The cops came, and the guys who handled the job, they cut me a break. They let me go. And you know what? That's where I learned my lesson about people, places, and things. I had no business being in an environment like that. And I have since found a place that sells real good roast beef without being in that type of place. And I haven't been in a place like that since, you know. I was sober just under a year. And all the men in the group were going on a retreat. And they kind of tricked me, because you can trick new people. Especially like if you catch them off guard, like if you come up behind them, then ask them a question because you don't have time to formulate an answer. And they came up to me and they said, "Bobby, you're working this weekend?" And I knew the answer should have been why. But I said, no, it came out quick. I said, no, I'm not. They said, "Good, we're going on a retreat this weekend. We're going to take you with us." And I said, okay. Now, I hated these guys, right? But I really wanted to hang out with them. And they would ask me, but I would say no because I had something better to do. And I didn't. And there were times I went home by myself, but I hated them. But I wanted to hang out with them. But they weren't really always nice to me. I was just nuts. But I said, okay. So I'd go. So, and they knew something was up because, you know, I wasn't saying the prayers. So they figured something had to be up. And I was angry anyway. So I'm sitting in the back of the car and driving up, and I got this knot in my stomach, and I can't tell them why I don't do the prayer. I can't tell them about my mom, you know, God forbid. So, but the need for me to be accepted by these guys outweighed anything else, so I was willing to put myself in that jackpot. Where they drop me off, you know, they go about their rooms, I wander around, I'm there about 10, 15 minutes. I run into the retreat master. He's my disciplinarian from high school. As soon as he saw me, he had a big old smile. He was a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Man, it's great to see you." He started talking to me and wanted to know what was going on. He said, "Listen, how long are you sober?" I'm telling him what the deal is. You know, he said, "Listen, you got a home group? You got a sponsor?" I said, "No, I don't. I ain't got a home. I don't have a sponsor." Because I'm a pretty bright guy. But I don't tell him that, but I am. I'm a bright guy and I don't need a sponsor. He said, "I strongly suggest you get a sponsor." I said, "All right, I'll get one." So I asked my roommate to be my sponsor, just in case I was ever questioned again. People say, "Bobby, you got a sponsor?" I said, "Yeah, there he goes, right there." And the only time I talked to this guy is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. He would wave to me, said, "Bobby, I still got that same phone number." I said, "Yeah, I'll give you a call." I never called him. Nobody used to do it. Oh, you won't believe this guy. He got me doing this. He got me doing that. I made it all up. He didn't do nothing. He put the hand of AA out there, and I'm the one who slapped it away and talked about it. You know, God bless him, a good guy. I was sober 23 months, I beat another man with a baseball bat. I forget what step I was working that day. I was just nuts. I was nuts, I swear to God. Swear to God, true story. My early recovery, first couple years, I used to go to a lot of go-go bars, right? But I ordered soda. And I would get my pictures taken, right? And I would go to the meetings and pass the pictures around to the old-timers. And they would look at the picture and look at me, and they would shake their head. And they would say, "Please keep coming back." Because I figured they would like me if I showed them that stuff. I was nuts. My second anniversary come. Oh, in fact, I skipped something. My 1 year anniversary came, and you know, I told my story, and it was like I got done. It was like thunderous applause. It, like the lame could walk, the blind could see. And people came up and they patted me on the back and say, "Way to go, Bobby! You're doing so well." I lied during the entire thing. I made everything up. The fact that I identified myself as an alcoholic was a lie, because in my head at that time, because I didn't believe I was an alcoholic, and in my group you couldn't talk about anything other. So I identified myself as a group conscience dictated, and I made all types of things up. I gave them the quotes, I gave them the literature, you know, and they patted me in the back, said, "You're doing so good." And I was dying inside because I lied to them the entire time. In fact, when I was speaking, a bottle of beer appeared in my head, but you guys didn't want to hear that. You wanted to hear all the quotes. I gave you what you wanted to hear. So time comes on, second anniversary. I don't celebrate it. I'm crazy as a bed bug. 1 month after my second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, but 25 months before, I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was dying from untreated alcoholism, and I made meetings on a daily basis, sometimes two or three, depending what shift I was working. You know, I was nuts. You know, and people were avoiding me because I was crazy. And the only time I got my hand up was to share was like the cross talk, you know, shoot somebody down. And I would share something from the floor, you know, from my seat, and I'd get up and go to the men's room, I'd get something to drink, I'd come back, and the seat next to me would be empty. They'd be sitting on the other side of the room. They'd try to avoid me. And then I would glare at them, try to stare them down. I was nuts. I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering why everybody was blowing this guy's anonymity. I said, you know what? I said, he's really a tough SOB. I wouldn't want to tangle with this guy. Swear, when I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid. But here I was. I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. In my home group, we had your corkboard, first name, last initial, and, you know, for the month, anniversaries, how many years, and the date of month it, you know, fell on. I'm not proud of this. It's true. I hated everybody, but you know who I hated the most? I hated the guys behind me. How dare they get better before me, you know? Because, like, I could fake the talk, which I did, but you could tell that I was a lunatic. But these guys had a glow about them. You couldn't fake that. So I'm caught up on the seniority list, right? So if Joey A. got 3 years and Bobby C. got 2 years and Joey went out, I was glad. I said, good. He's out. I move up. I was nuts. I was crazy. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had. I was carrying the disease. I didn't carry the message. I was nuts. 26 months sober, I'm in a meeting one day, and I see this guy, you know, like I said, I want to eat my gun. I see this guy from my neighborhood. His nickname was Troubles. That's a hard-earned nickname. But no one really a rough dude, and he was in and out of jail in like the 60s and 70s. And I saw him in my neighborhood, and I knew he was for real, because it wasn't in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in a neighborhood where it's tough to stay sober, you know? Strange phenomenon in my neighborhood. Like, things happen, they fall off the back of trucks. You know, it's like we got that Bermuda Triangle in South Philly. Everyone got a deal, you know? Everyone got things so tremendously discounted, and all types of other behaviors going on. And I was, you know, involved in this stuff, sober, it's just nuts. But Bobby was for real. He wasn't about any of that stuff. And so I went up to him. I said, "Bobby, I need some help." I said, "Would you be my sponsor?" And he looked at me dead in the eye. He said, "Bobby, I've been watching you for these past couple years." And I'm thinking, wow, he likes me. He said, "I need to tell you." He said, "You're full of shit." Now, obviously, that's not the response I'm looking for. He said, "I'm going to sponsor you under certain conditions. A, you're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting a week. You're going to go to a men's meeting a week. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment. And you're going to leave them damn women alone." And I'm looking at him, and I'm saying to myself, like, who's he talking to? I've been sober a little over 2 years here. I'm still in the grapevines. Like, what's happening here? But what I did do, I looked him dead in the eyes. That's okay. That's what I'm willing to do. And that's the night that I believed I took the first three steps, you know? I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. There's no question about that. But I went to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. And you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And you know what? I knew about the higher power, regardless of my resentment towards God, another issue. I knew that the higher power was working because I didn't believe anybody else, but I had personal experience. The guys behind me, younger than me in sobriety, I knew it was working for them. Like when I first got sober, when I heard people with 8, 10 years sobriety, I thought you were lying. You know, I thought you could drink in Jersey and keep your Pennsylvania time. You know, there's all this, you know, crazy things, you know, there's all this other stuff going on. Your secret meetings where you really get it. But I knew these guys. I saw these guys coming in, and I knew they were getting well. So I knew something was working. I just had an issue that I was not willing to address. And then we went back to my then sponsor's house, and I got on my knees, and we said the third step prayer together. And he told me, he said, Bobby, he said, there's a difference between making a decision and making a commitment. And that's the night I made a commitment. I was willing to go to any length to get sober. And he introduced me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he introduced me to the program, the 12 steps. And I was around, I heard things, but you know what? It wasn't really big in my group at that time. You know, it was one of these, you know, just don't drink and, you know, go to a meeting. And I'm a pretty bright guy, like I've told you. And I said, well, if I could just not drink, why do I need to go to a meeting? Why just cut that stuff out, you know? And then people say, just don't drink. And I would do all these crazy behaviors, and I would come to a meeting and talk about this stuff, and they said, that's all right, just don't drink. And I took it as, well, I could do whatever the hell I want to do as long as I don't drink. And I now know that's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, it's a contradiction to the first step. People say, just don't drink no matter what. Well, you know what? I drank no matter what. I drank when I was working, when I had money. When I was suspended, I drank because I took your money. I drank when I had a girlfriend, and when she dumped me, I drank because I felt sorry for myself. You know, St. Patty's Day, you know, Labor Day, you know, October 3rd, it didn't matter, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I drank. I tried to stop drinking lots of times, you know. I would try to give it up because I was threatened with suspension from my work because I was abusing my sick time. I would go on the wagon for a bit because the girl I was with at the time, she said, Bobby, you're a nice guy, but when you drink, you're a pig. I would give it up, try to give it up for Lent, but I can never stay stopped. I tried stop many times, but I can never stay stopped. So I know that, you know, I drink no matter what. You know, birds fly, fish swim, drunks drink, you know. So I never understood. People say, just don't drink. That implies willpower. And myself, I have no willpower whatsoever. So my sponsor told me, he said, we got to do one of these inventories. And I didn't want to do one of these. You know, I'm going to meetings and people say, whoa, easy does it. You don't want to get well too soon and all this other crazy shit, you know. And I'll talk later, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. I said, yeah, you're right. You know, I was just nuts. And I didn't want to do one of these. But, whoa, you may go out. I was on my way out not doing it. And I said, what do I have to lose? And I did my fourth step. And you know what? It wasn't that bad. Everything I wrote down, I did. There were no secrets that jumped out. The tough one was the next one when I was going to have to talk to my sponsor. But I'm a pretty bright guy. So I called my sponsor up and said, Bobby, I'm going to go up on this retreat and do this with my priest up there. He said, Bobby, that's great. He said, when you get done, stop by my house. And you know how sponsors could be. Like, you're on the phone, you're looking at it, and I guess he sensed it. Yeah. He said, Bobby, did you hear me? I said, yeah. Did you hear me? He said, yeah. He said, did you hear me? He said, when you get done, you come by my house. And then before I could object or rationalize or justify or do whatever, he said, Bobby, the reason is I'm your sponsor. If I want to help you with these character defects, I think I need to know what they are. All right. And the truth was, the reason I wanted to go with this priest, just because I had the church down as on the list, the resentment was still there. It wasn't to be any spiritual enlightenment or not. I was afraid of some of the things I would tell Bobby, that he would ridicule me, he would pass judgment on me, or even worse, he would take some of the things I tell him and break the confidence. You know. And I knew if I went on a retreat, I didn't have to worry about that. I never did my fifth step with a priest. I did it with my sponsor, and all those things were unfounded fears. You know, he didn't do any of those things. In fact, you know what he did? When I got done, he shared some of his stuff with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness that I thought that I was the only guy to do certain things. And to be honest, that's the best thing he could ever have done for me. It was just incredible, you know. And then I'm on my way out the doors. Whoa, whoa, where are you going? And because I knew what he was going to say, the quietly for the hour bit. And I said, well, I'll do that at home. He said, nah. I said, I got a quiet room upstairs. You can sit up there and do it. And I'm glad he did, because I would have probably got distracted because I was a little uncomfortable too. And you know what? I sat quietly. Now, my experience may be different from yours, but I can only talk about mine. The screaming inside stopped. Now, that may not sound like a lot to you, but to me, it was incredible. My head was always racing, you know? And no, I mean, no other experience, but that was it. The screaming inside stopped. And it was an incredible experience, you know. 6 and 7, because I didn't burn my fourth step, I knew what my character defects were. Now, I never knew what they were. I never knew what they were. But in fact, you know, I knew I was a character when I drank. But, you know, truth was, when I did my inventory, I had no character whatsoever. You couldn't trust me. I wasn't dependable. I wasn't reliable. I wasn't honorable. I wasn't honest. I was none of that stuff. I was so self-centered. I cared about me and whatever values that were instilled in me as a kid and through the Jesuits and everything else went out the window. You know, I cared about me and nothing else, you know. The A step, because again, I didn't burn my four step, half my A step was done. And I was one of these guys who go to meetings and say, well, I didn't harm anybody but myself. Right there is a tip off that I never did an inventory. Like I said, I harmed everybody I came in contact with. So I had to put more names on there. And the ninth step, I became, you know, I made direct amends. You know, no phone calls or no letters from me, because I didn't hit you with a bat over the phone or through the mail. And I could justify wanting to take those types of actions, but the truth is, if I'm really honest, I'm afraid. I'm afraid to face you, you know. And my sponsor said, Bobby, direct amends. And I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step. I was at a meeting one time, about 11 years ago, and it was in Northwest Philadelphia. I live in South Philadelphia. And I saw this guy. I'm sitting at the table, and this guy walks down the steps. I have not seen this man since 1978. Not through any fear or anything like that, just out of sight, out of mind. I just forgot. But as soon as I saw him, I recognized him. And we grew up together in my neighborhood. And I remember one day I was involved in it. We had words in a bar, and he kind of backed down. So from that point on, whenever I wanted to impress anybody how tough or nuts I was, I would publicly humiliate that man to make myself look big. And like I said earlier, I'm not a tough guy. I never was. In fact, I was always a terrified guy. But what I would do, I would publicly humiliate him. I would verbally abuse him. One day I even spit on him. I mean, what worse thing can you do to a human being but to spit on him? You talk about the utter contempt. I would slap him, you know. I see this guy. So I get introduced and I stand up and say, my name is Bobby Coyle, I'm an alcoholic. Now I need to tell you why I use my full name. A lot of our traditions are misunderstood, but you know, this 11th one is a biggie. The 11th tradition is real clear. At the level of press, radio, and film, you will not see my full picture with my full name on the radio or on the television and the newspaper identifying myself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the 11th tradition. You know, we get sober, all of a sudden, we're joining the mafia. You know, we get all these nicknames. There's Bucktooth Mary and Red Sweater Jerry and Frank the Fox and Pepsi George. We get all these nicknames. I don't want no one to know that I'm sober. Everybody in my neighborhood knew I was a lunatic drunk. It was those little telltale signs. They come out and they catch me, I'd be urinating in their car. My girlfriend threw the clothes out the window. I'm slumped behind the wheel of my car. Everybody knows I'm a drunk. All of a sudden, I get sober. I don't want no one to know. Like, my reputation, I'm worried about. It's nuts. It's crazy. Well, God forbid you want to drink 3 o'clock in the morning, you call information. I'd like to have Bucktooth Mary's phone number. You're out of luck. Or God forbid you want to visit one of these old-timers, I'm here to visit Frank the Fox. If they got a nut ward, they're going to put you in it. Dr. Bob was real clear. He said, where one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that is a violation of the 11th tradition. He said, anonymity is spiritually inspired, secrecy is spirit inspired. You know. However, I have no right whatsoever to break anybody else's anonymity. I've just been involved in my area, various levels of service back home, and we just use our full names. So that's why I use my full name, because you're not going to find Bobby C. in the phone book. You'll find Robert Ignatius Coyle III. But, all right, off that soapbox. So I'm at this meeting, and I see this guy. So my name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. He nodded. He recognized me then. I get sober up. We clean up, right? When I got done speaking, I told the group what I did to this guy, because my sponsor told me that ninth step, making amends, it's much more than saying I'm sorry. It's about righting a wrong. And I figured if I publicly humiliated him, the least I could do was to apologize to him publicly. And it wasn't the grandstand, but I figured that's the least I can do. So I looked him dead in the eye and said, Bob, I'm terribly sorry for the way I treated you. And as long as I'm sober, I hope I don't treat you or any other human being that way again. You know what? He came up and he hugged me. It was an incredible experience. Now we start talking, right? And I said, Bob, I haven't seen you in years. What's going on? He said, Bobby, he said, I'm sober 3 years. And right away, the arrogance kicks in. Well, you're sober 3 years. You got to know me. I mean, I'm everywhere, right? But I'm living in South Philly. This meeting's in North Philly, and Bobby's living, his name's Bob also. It's Bob. His last name's not also. His name's also Bob. I don't know if I can get his anonymity. So, but he's living in Northwest Philly. I said, Bobby, what brings you to this meeting tonight? He said, Bobby, I was flipping through the meeting list, and for some reason, this meeting just jumped at me, and I just want to come here. Now, I need to tell you, we have 1,600 meetings a week, and this meeting just jumped at him. We were both in neighborhoods where we normally don't go to. I really believe that God put that guy in my path that night, and I had two options. I could take advantage of it or do what I always used to do. You could come up and you come from me and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, you got me confused. You're probably talking about my brother Joey or Brian or somebody like that." Because when you're that close in age, there's a strong resemblance. And I did that lots of times. People, "Hey, you son of a..." No, my brother, not me. But I had the opportunity to make amends, and it was a credible experience. A flip side of that, I was at this my home group at that for a while, was the Stepping Stones group in Philadelphia. I made a motion at the business meeting. It was definitely for the betterment of AA since I made it. And my boy Freddie led the opposition. I couldn't believe it. Because I grew up in a type of neighborhood, right, wrong, or indifferent, you're back to your boys. That's just the way, it was like one of the rules. We got lots of rules in the neighborhood. That was one of them. You always, "Oh yeah, but I'm behind you." I couldn't believe he did that. And my motion went down in flames, you know, wasn't even seconded. I said, "Christ." I would come to meetings from that point on. There'd be four men sitting at the table. I'd say hi to three of them. I wouldn't say hi to Freddie. I would completely ignore him. I was hurt, mad. I was nuts. I'm at work one day. One of my coworkers came up to me. He said, "Bobby," he said, "Freddie Wheels is outside. He went to take care of some sort of business." I peeked out the window. I seen him. I said, "Tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall to do that. He can't do that here." A few weeks after that, that same old coworker called me up at home. I was off that day. He said, "Bobby," he said, "Freddie Wheels died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you." Now, here he was, a friend of mine for many years. And as God is my judge, I don't know what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. And he was put in my path numerous, numerous times. And I chose not to make amends. The word is wherever, not whenever. Because for us, you know, we're too busy, easy, doesn't it? You know, get it again. Wherever denotes place, whenever is time. You know, and God put that guy in my path many, many times, and I never took advantage of it. And as soon as that coworker said, "Bobby, he always spoke so highly of you," I felt about yay big, and I've been praying for Freddie ever since. So that's two examples in a ninth step, you know, where I took the action, I reaped the rewards, I failed to take the action, I paid the price. The 10th step for me is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I'm going to stand up here and tell you I do a 10th step every day, that's not true. And I used to be one of these guys, "Well, you know, no one knows but me." That's not true either. Because when I'm not practicing these principles, I become a nitwit. And should you come across me during the day, you're affected by that, you know? You know the old saying, you can't miss what you never had? Well, you know, in early recovery, you know, serene people scared the hell out of me. So I would have to get my hand up to share something crazy to get it comfortable, because I was goofy with comfortableness. You know, I was comfortable with goofiness, you know? But now, you know, I no longer like living like that. In fact, when I hear things insane or whatnot, I try to bring it back, you know, because I now miss that peace of mind. So when I'm off the beam, I know what I need to do to get back on the beam. But I'm fairly consistent on the 10th step, sometimes 4 or 5 times a week, sometimes 2, sometimes 1. I try to stay sober on yesterday's sobriety, and it never fails. Every single time I do, I pay the price. The 11th step through prayer and meditation, to improve my conscious contact. I definitely got a conscious contact with my higher power. No doubt about it, you know. I no longer have a resentment towards God. I don't hate the church or anything like, you know. And I found that out through the steps. The church wasn't the problem. My mom was just a sick woman. The military wasn't the problem. The police department wasn't the problem. The neighborhood I grew up in wasn't the problem. Being a mommer wasn't the problem. I was the problem, Bobby Coyle. And that's what I found out through the steps. And there was a lot of things about my past that I'm not proud of. And I would change in a heartbeat, but I can't. But another great thing about the steps, obviously it removed the obsession to drink. One of the greatest rewards is I haven't had the urge to take my life. But most importantly, it has changed my attitude about my past. And I can now share my past with anybody, you know. And I believe that's what I'm supposed to do in the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry this message. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been to thousands of meetings since I've been sober. I hear some crazy things. I got to look up the slogans to make sure I'm in an AA meeting. You know, that's the message. Tried to carry this message. Sometimes I forget that word tries in there, you know. When I first got involved in the steps, after that, I had the fireman's hat on. I went through my evangelical period. But I kind of chilled for the past few years because I now know that I'm responsible for the effort, not the outcome. But most importantly is to practice these principles in all my affairs. I'm only in an AA meeting an hour and a half a day. What about the other 22 and a half hours? What about the time on my job? What about the time in my neighborhood, like I said earlier? You know, it's a great neighborhood, but a lot of funny things going on there. You know, I got to practice these principles in all my affairs. Now, I don't run around and tell people that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what? I've had the privilege to help people. One of the things that happened was my neighbor Joe. Joe lived right across the street from us. Joe had a bar, the corner bar. It was a toilet. In fact, if you came in, you said, "Where's the toilet?" I said, "You're standing in it." The dump of a bar. Towards the end of my drinking, Joe said, "Bobby, you can't come in here." Now, he knew me. He saw me grow up as a kid. He knew my family for years. He knew what I did for a living. None of that stuff mattered to him. He said, "You can't come in here. And if you come in here, I'm going to," and, you know, some colorful language. I said, "Okay, Joe. I just found another place to drink." About 7 years ago, Joe called my dad up. And then my dad gave him my number. And Joe called me up. He said, "Bobby, you still go to MAA meetings?" I said, "Yeah, Joe, I do." See, and he knew, because in my neighborhood, bad news travels quickly. Like we hit the old drums, you know. Like no one wants to talk about the good news, like so-and-so got promoted or got married, but we love the bad news, you know. Quickly it travels. He said, "I was wondering if you could help me." He said, "My nephew Jimmy is just getting out of treatment, and I was wondering if you could take him to a meeting." Now what happened, Jimmy, his parents were killed in an automobile accident when he was a kid, and Joe and his wife took his brothers and sisters in and raised them as their own. Here was a guy that years before did not allow me in the toilet of a bar that he owned. Now that he was trusting me to take his nephew, who was 17 years old, take him to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you know, because I didn't have to run around and tell people I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I tried to practice these principles in all my affairs, you know. And I was able to do that, you know. And Jimmy just had 8 years a couple months ago, you know. And and it was nothing I did. It's God doing the work, because I work with lots of guys that didn't get sober, you know. And but that's what I try to do today, you know. And because I believe it's my responsibility. In fact, we even got that statement, you know. When anybody anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. I can't rely on anybody else, you know. I make regular attendance at meetings. I go to meetings, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 times a week. It depends on what, and I got a lot of things going on in my life. But I still go to regular attendance at meetings, because everything I got going on in my life today is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if the preamble says my primary purpose is to stay sober and help the other alcoholic to achieve sobriety, if I'm only staying sober and I'm not helping the other alcoholic, that's half measures, and half measures avail us nothing. And the new guy doesn't know that I live at 707 Sears Street. That's why I go to meetings, to meet the new guy. Like I go to meetings sometimes and some of my sponsees will come up to me and they haven't called me in a while. I said, "Listen, talk to that guy over there, because you already got my phone number. You haven't called me in 3 or 4 days. But there's a new guy over there. We've never seen him before. Let's talk to him." That's why I go to meetings, because there were men there for me, you know. You know, I enjoy doing it, but again, like Dr. Bob, I feel like it's a sense of obligation, you know, and I love doing it, you know, because regardless of what I got going on in my personal life, when I'm helping somebody else, I'm out of myself. Now, I'm not the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell people, come live with me for a week. I'm sure I could be a difficult guy to get along with. I'm quirky, I'm a bit goofy, but you know what? I'm not intentionally harming people. I'm not whacking guys with bats. I'm not using other people's credit cards. You know, for the most part, I treat people with dignity and respect, because that's what the men in Alcoholics Anonymous did for me. I love AA. You know, one of my favorite sayings in the Big Book says, "We absolutely insist on enjoying life. If the newcomer can see no joy in our existence, they won't want nothing to do with us." Now, obviously, I just paraphrased that last sentence. Bill was a hell of a lot more eloquent than I was. But still, you get the deal, you know. So if you're new and you think, "Oh, Christ, I got to make AA meetings for the rest of my life," you know, you got to put the hair shirt on and whack yourself, you know, you're greatly mistaken. Whatever you did drunk, you could do stone cold sober. Be better at it, have more fun, and most of all, remember it. You know, I got sober in my 20s. I was 27, and, you know, I got a good life today. I really do. I alluded a couple times that I'm a mummer, you know, and I usually save this for the end because I know I always confuse the hell out of people. Mummers, let's see. It's a New Year's parade we do in Philadelphia. It's been going for a couple hundred years. It's really since in the 1700s. But it was officially recognized in 1901. The city wanted to control the mayhem. And what it is, it's like a combination of the Mardi Gras and the Full Monty. What it is, it's a bunch of men, usually drunk, in sequins, feathers, and makeup, and we dance in the middle of the street and play instruments. It's a blast. It's the longest continuous parade in the country. It goes about 13 hours. There's 30,000 of us. It's just nuts. But it's a drunk fest. It's New Year's Day. It's bitter cold. We're out there strutting. It's a blast. It's a great time. When I got sober, I couldn't strut no more. Now I'm a third-generation mummer. I just couldn't do it no more. So I'm at a meeting one night, and I'm telling my story, and a kid came up to me afterwards and said, Bobby, would you be in? And besides, mummers itself, it's taken from Mummus, who was the Greek god of ridicule. So there's a little clash to us. You know, we're not all. So I'm in this midnight meeting. I'm telling my story, and a kid came up to me afterwards and said, Bobby, would you be interested in watching the parade this year? I said, whoa, you're out of your mind. People, places, and things. I got no business being there. He said, you don't understand. He said, we got a group together called the 12 Steppers. Sober mummers. It's like, it's an oxymoron, sober mummers. It just, and so last year, January 1st, 2002, I marched in my 34th parade. And this coming year will be the 12th year of the 12 Steppers. And I'm only, me and two other guys, we're the only three original members left. And it's a blast. 4 years ago, our brigade came in first place. That's incredible. All the years I marched, well, I could never. I would leave my house like on New Year's Eve in my costume, and I would show up back home like the 4th or the 5th, not remember nothing. But here I was, New Year's Day in Philadelphia, going up the street with a bunch of sober dudes. I mean, if we can do that sober, anything is possible. It's so... If you ever come to Philly, I invite you to come to the parade. It's a blast. I guess I'm going to finish up real soon. I was in 1993. I got diagnosed with cancer, and it was a real fluke way the way I found out. So I went to go get a second opinion, and it got confirmed: lung cancer. I never smoked in my life. A little reefer for a short period of time, but I never smoked a cigarette. I can't believe this. So. I didn't handle this well. You know, I was sober for a while, you know, doing the right thing. And again, this sense of entitlement. And I remember driving home, the very first thought that popped in my head, Bobby, you could smoke marijuana because people on chemotherapy smoke pot. You could do that. And I didn't smoke any pot. And I'll tell you why. Because at this point, I've been to many meetings. And I saw some people, men and women, go through some terrible things through no fault of their own. And they got through it without picking up a drink, you know. I get uncomfortable when people say AA doesn't promise you anything. AA promises you many, many things, and they're not material things, but they can come about, but they're not the promises. They're the intangibles you can't put a price on. Real friendship, peace of mind, serenity, things like that, you know. And so I start going through treatment, you know, and I went in remission, and then I got sick again, and I got really sick, and things weren't looking so good for a while. And I tell you, you talk about finishing up some 9-step work, you know, because I was one of those guys, oh, I was out there forever, I'll never get it done. That was just setting up some sort of excuse, but, you know, because I still had that indoctrination as a kid, the scales were still like this, so I needed to bounce them out. But they eventually removed the lower left lobe of my lung. I had surgery, and I was really sick. And when I got out of the hospital, I was laid up for a while, and I couldn't make meetings. I always made meetings. I was very involved in the area. In fact, my goal was to be, I was talking at dinner tonight, was to be one of the youngest delegates from my area. And I had to give my position up because I just couldn't serve. I just didn't have the strength, you know. And then, again, that's ego. But I was laid up in my house. And I know the doctors did a pretty good job. But you know what? People start coming to my house and carrying a message. And I'm just not talking about friends. I'm talking about people I met at the assembly or, you know, other places. And they came to my house and said, people that I didn't really know that well, and carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're looking at a liar, a thief, and a cheat. I took my entire life. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people came to my house to carry the message of AA. You know, it's a credible experience. 12 years ago, I was in Mexico. I thought I could speak Spanish. I was the only English-speaking person in the room. Those poor people are probably still figuring out what the hell I said. Yeah. My Spanish consisted of like, dame pistola, give me your gun. So I start speaking Spanish, and I could tell by their looks, they didn't figure it out. So I switched over to English, and they still don't know what the hell I was saying. But you know what? When I got done, they came up and they hugged me. And I could tell who the old timer was by the serenity in their face. And I could tell who the new guy was by the pain in their face. They didn't understand, but you know what? They understood. Language of the heart, incredible experience. In a couple of weeks, the anniversary of I guess, changed the country, September 11th. I go up to New York fairly often. It's fairly close to, from my house to Manhattan. It's probably about an hour and 15-minute drive. And back in August, they asked me to come up, and they had a couple Tuesdays open. They said, listen, we got either the first Tuesday or the second Tuesday, the 4th or the 11th. And I was on vacation. I was out in San Francisco, and I came back through Labor Day week. And I said, you know what, I'll come up on the 4th because, you know, I don't go back to work till the following week. And I went up. I had dinner with a couple guys, and, you know, we went out to dinner, and then we went to a meeting. And then the following week, the 11th, and one of the guys I was with, you know, wound up getting killed there. And 2 days later, you know, I served on this special team in Philly, and we got sent up to New York, and I wound up working up there for about 4 or 5 days. And on that, went up there on Thursday, which was the 13th. On Saturday, the 15th, I had a break for a couple hours, and I went over to the funeral for the chaplain, who happened to be a friend of ours. And I couldn't get in because all the dignitaries were there, but they had the speakers outside his church, which was right across the street from the fire station, which lost 11 guys. And I'm standing down on the sidewalk, and I must run into about 8 or 9 different people from the program. And they said, Bobby, what are you doing up here? And so we start talking. And the reason I bring this up, that, you know, how it affected my recovery and how it affected AA in the New York area. Whenever I see things like that on television, like, you know, floods or tornadoes, I always think, what happens in AA? How's the AA community making out? Like a number of years ago, I had the privilege, I was up at Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I was up there like the year after the great flood they had up there. And I guess there's a friend of mine, Dan, here. I met him. I was in Burlington, Iowa. I guess it was last year. And shortly after, I met a lot of people from Davenport. And shortly after that, they had all this flooding. And I always said, what happens in the AA community? What goes on up there? Well, there were quite a few groups. There was actually an AA group that met in the towers. And needless to say, they're no longer around. And there were a couple of groups that were displaced. The general service office was closed for a couple of days. But people start calling up. And they started offering help, you know, and allowing people meeting places. And there was an actual group. There was a Ground Zero group that started that I had the privilege to attend from the various rescue workers up there. And regardless of what was going on, people were still able to get through with terrible tragedy without picking up a drink, and to the point where it was almost even stronger than before, you know. So, and again, I guess that's for the new guy. Whatever you think you got going on, a drink's not the answer. Get yourself a home group. Get yourself a sponsor. Get involved. You know, get involved in service. You know, it's a whole it's the whole ball of wax. It's not just one piece, you know, in my experience, you know. It's about prayer. It's about service. It's about action. It's a wonderful way of life. I wouldn't trade anything, you know. I wouldn't trade anything. And in a couple of weeks, I was up there for the closing ceremony at Ground Zero, and I was going back up for the 11th, the anniversary. And just a tremendous experience. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll finish with this. You know, when I started, I said that I always lied. I always sold myself short. I compromised my values and principles because the need to be accepted by people outweighed anything else. Well, I no longer need to do that. And you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous accept me for who I am, warts and all. So I really thank the committee for the privilege of participating in an AA meeting, and that's all I got. Thanks.